On a Monday, it is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at the policy agenda of a children's mental health advocacy group. It's called Wisconsin Family Ties. Governor Evers' two-year spending plan proposes a big boost to education funding, including $47 million more in mental health aid for schools. DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, also seeks more aid for trauma sensitivity school training. DPI published newly available data on the use of seclusion and restraint in schools. Nearly half of all Wisconsin schools reported at least one incident where either seclusion or physical restraint was used last school year. Has your child been secluded or restrained? How did you feel afterward? How has your school approached such practices? It's 800-642-1234. Hugh Davis is Executive Director of Wisconsin Family Ties. Hugh, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks very much for having me.
Why is having this data on the use of isolation and restraint tactics in our schools, why is that important to you?
First and foremost, I think it's important because the visibility has resulted in us talking today, Kate. Mm-hmm. Prior to this, there was no statewide reporting of these incidents. And so even though we knew what was going on, we did public records requests for about 3 years worth of data, which found that there were roughly 20,000 incidents of seclusion and restraint every year, and that the very vast majority, about 80%, were happening with students with disabilities. And when we talked to individuals about this, we talk about the incidents of seclusion and restraint. They would say usually, well, that's not happening here, is it? And then we tell them that it happens about 20,000 times each year in schools, and they were totally shocked. And yet there was no, because it was us having to get a public records request to get that data, there was no widespread understanding of that. So in the update of the law in 2020, we felt it was really important to have visibility about this. And so I think it's borne out by the number of newspaper articles that have been written and the fact that we're talking about it today. And hopefully the next step then is for us to actually do something about that and use more humane, more compassionate ways to deal with challenging behavior.
So these tactics, you say, of using seclusion and restraint happening with 80% with students with disabilities, 4 out of 5 times these tactics are used, it's with a student with a disability.
Yes. Yeah.
What is going on
specifically
there?
There's not a incredible insight into the data because the data just reports that information. So it's a little hard to disaggregate that and to come up with any other conclusions specifically. But we do believe that a significant portion of this is used with children who have emotional or behavioral challenges. They're the ones most likely to have challenging behavior in school settings, be less compliant than most other students. And unfortunately, compliance is a major trigger to these incidents occurring. I think that that's probably why we're seeing this mostly with students with disabilities. The other thing that is that we found in our multiple years of public records requests, that it was also the vast majority of these techniques were used on younger students, elementary age students. Hmm. That's another issue that we could clearly take a look at in trying to reduce the utilization of these techniques.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a state law that requires schools to now report whenever they isolate or restrain students. We're talking about it with Hugh Davis, who is Executive Director of Wisconsin Family Ties, which pushed an organization which pushed for the law. What do you think about the use of isolation and restraints in schools? Should these practices be banned? Should there be exceptions for certain situations? 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. You mentioned, Hugh, the elementary level, and several elementary schools reported hundreds of cases involving these practices in the 2019-2020 school year. How concerned are you that students are being isolated or restrained too often?
Very concerned about that. I think that if you would look at the research, particularly around seclusion, there has been absolutely no benefit found to secluding a student. There is federal legislation that's been introduced several times, has not passed, it's called Keeping All Students Safe Act, and that act would actually ban the use of seclusion. That is an approach that we at Wisconsin Family Ties support. We don't think there's any reason to seclude a child. So I think that that would help. If you take a look at the number of incidents that DPI reported, that would cut the number in about half if we took out the seclusion. When it comes to restraint, that's a little more challenging, and we're not saying that those measures should be banned, but we do believe that we ought to look more critically at when restraint is used. Restraint should be used as a last resort when nothing else has helped and when someone's safety is at imminent risk. And so in those cases, it is absolutely warranted. And we want people to be able to restrain someone who is either going to hurt themselves or hurt someone else. That is reasonable. It's common sense. And so we're not looking to ban restraint altogether, but we are looking at or wanting people to look at it more critically.
Yeah, so putting parameters around when it's used and when it is not appropriate. More than 1,000 schools in the state reported no incidents of isolation or restraints last school year. Could this mean schools are not properly reporting the incidents? What's going on there?
It's possible. I don't want to make any kind of, I don't want to speculate about that. But when we collected our data beginning in the 2013-14 school year, we saw a similar kind of response where we had schools that were either not reporting, did not respond to the public records request at all, or were reporting no incidents. And while I think that's perfectly possible, the likelihood of it seemed pretty long, given the fact of how prevalent the use of seclusion and restraint was in other school districts.
Do you think that there needs to be some clarifying legislation to improve the state's tracking of isolation and restraints, or so schools know exactly how to properly report it?
Well, the latest update, which was 2019 Act 118, did provide a lot of clarification.
Okay.
And so the clarification should already be there in state law. I think that it might be, this is the first year that this data has been reported to DPI. So there may be some additional training that is needed to make sure that schools are fully understanding what their requirements are under the law. But the clarification was provided in that act.
Hugh Davis, he heads up Wisconsin Family Ties. It's an organization that helps families with children who have mental health challenges. What do you think of a proposed ban on restricting minors in courtrooms for most cases? On restraining minors in courtrooms in most cases. How could lawmakers or state agencies help improve access to youth mental health services? What's working in your community? Where has your family felt stuck in getting help? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about youth mental health and the policy agenda of an organization that provides peer support to families with children who have mental health challenges. Wisconsin Family Ties was founded more than 30 years ago by a group of parents who wanted to improve children's mental health. What do you think of Governor Evers' state budget proposal to boost mental health aid to schools? What do you think of schools using physical restraint and seclusion tactics? 800-642-1234. Hugh Davis is executive director of Wisconsin Family Ties. He's with us for 10 more minutes. Let's go to Belinda now in Phillips. Hi, Belinda. What would you like to say?
Hi, good morning. So I have a special needs child. He's in second grade now. And we've been to a couple of different schools in the northern region up here. So he actually had a couple incidents where he was restrained and or isolated at a school when he was in first grade. His behavior seriously declined. We were having more issues with him. And then we transferred over to a new school where they really kind of shy away from using those at all costs. And it's been amazing to see his development and growth. So I just happened to see, as a parent, just the deficit that some of those restraints and isolations had for him.
Belinda, thank you so much for sharing your personal perspective on this. A second grader with special needs and switched to a new school that isn't using the physical restraint and seclusion tactics. Hugh?
Yeah, well, I think that certainly shows, unfortunately, it's the experience of many parents and families in our state, way too many in my mind. But it also shows that it's not the kid that we have to worry about changing or fixing. It's that the difference can be made by adult attitudes, actions, and approaches. When we as adults alter what we do, because let's face it, the only behavior that we can control is our own. As much as we'd like to control someone else's, it's ourselves that we have the power over. When those adults take a look at what they're doing and their approaches and attitudes, kids improve. It's been proven time and time again. There's tons of research on it. And yet we tend to want to use these consequence-based approaches that, by and large, will work with neurotypical kids quite a bit, but not with kids who have, not with students with disabilities. Just does not work.
Let's bring in Susan now in Richland Center. Susan is a special education teacher. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just have a few things to say. First of all, every teacher has gone through a CPI training if you're going to have to restrain a student. And in that training, the last thing you ever do is you don't want to restrain a student. First of all, you lose that trust for them. You embarrass the student. There's a chance of both of you getting in hurt. And you do have to report. It does not matter. If you put a student in seclusion for 5 minutes because they need that time to calm down, or if you restrain, you have to do a report. And then the parents know about it. We don't advertise it. Not everybody has to know. But I just wish once in a while people need to come into the schools and actually see what's going on. So, you know, it is getting reported. This is a waste of time. And I just wish once in a while we would hear what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. We don't just restrain it. It has to be documented. It's the law. And it happens. And there are kids who cannot control their temper, and it has to happen for the safety of everybody. But it's the last resort.
Yes, Susan, thank you so much for bringing your perspective and, you know, saying that, look, this is last resort, Hugh.
It should be last resort, as I said earlier, and I'm not saying that we should ban restraint. She's right. According to the law, you do have to report it. I do think that there are lots of places across the nation who have dramatically reduced the use of seclusion and restraint. I think that you know, we should not think that we here in Wisconsin are so unique that we can't look at those same kinds of approaches. And so I would disagree with some of that that says that everything that is happening is necessary. We do know when we delve into some of these situations that the underlying issue starts with some sort of noncompliance. To me, noncompliance is not a reason to restrain a student. The time when you restrain is when it is a last resort. She also mentioned training that that school staff need to receive in order to restrain. So I'll just relate what a professor from one of the UW system universities told us a couple of years ago as we were looking into this situation, that they used that most prevalent training with their students who were going to go out to do their student teaching. And while it's true that that training does emphasize de-escalation over the use of restraint, it does teach how to restrain students. And what this professor found was that when the students were coming back from or talking about their student teaching experiences, one of the things that they were doing was they were talking about which restraint holds they used. That shocked the professor. And so what they have done is they've stopped training on how to restrain children. Mm-hmm. They train on the de-escalation part, but they've stopped using the restraint section of that training.
We are talking about youth mental health with Hugh Davis, Executive Director of Wisconsin Family Ties. The group advocates for parents of children with behavioral and emotional challenges. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Hugh, I want to switch gears here for a moment. You know, families have been under incredible stress this past year in the pandemic. Your organization provides that peer support for families. How do you help families through these times? What have you been hearing? What do you say and do?
I'll answer that in just one second. Kate, I did want to go back because the teacher who spoke mentioned something I think was important, saying that she wished that people would talk about the positive things that they do. And I can talk about that in terms of the pandemic. But I do want to say that I am probably one of the biggest supporters of public education in our state. Both of my parents were teachers. My brother is a teacher. My sister-in-law is a teacher. And my second daughter, is doing her student teaching right now to become a special education teacher. So I am an absolute strong supporter of public education in our state. I've testified for public education. I've protested for public education. So I am incredibly in awe of what teachers do on a daily basis. And when it comes to the pandemic, you know, we put more pressure on the education system than any other system, I believe. You know, they had to pivot on a weekend and go from in-person schooling to virtual schooling. And now many schools have hybrid school models where teachers are expected to engage students virtually as well as those in a classroom. So kudos to all teachers for hanging in there in what has got to be one of the most difficult times education has ever seen.
You go ahead. So, on the family component, how are you helping right now with these families in the stress they're experiencing?
Yes. So Wisconsin Family Ties probably had a little bit of an advantage over some other organizations because we have a geographically decentralized workforce. All of our parent peer specialists is what we call them. Are spread throughout the state, working out of their home offices, serving families in their local communities. So we managed our own internal organization virtually. We used the technology available, we used Zoom, phone, email, whatever we had to in order to manage our organization. So it was fairly easy for us to turn to use those same technologies that we had always been using to work with families. So we continued to do the same things that we always have done in providing support for those families, emotional support for those families, in helping them navigate really complex systems, helping them get their needs met, and providing some training and coaching along the way. So we've done all of those things. I will say, though, it has been more difficult, especially as people get burned out on the virtual model. There are, you know, everything is virtual. And I think we're now starting, you know, we've experienced for some time now people who are not willing to have the same depth of conversation that they were in person over technology. So we're looking forward to the end of the pandemic when we can meet face to face with those families.
Hugh, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate. I really appreciate the time.
Hugh Davis is Executive Director of Wisconsin Family Ties. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with State Senator Kathy Bernier of Chippewa Falls. We discuss how elections are run. That's after a news update here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. State senators unveiled a package of bills last month aimed at changing how elections are run. The bills cover a broad set of issues. We will work through them, starting with how voters qualify for the status of indefinitely confined. Did you register as indefinitely confined in last year's presidential election? How do you think the status should be determined? Do you support restricting who is eligible to vote absentee? Do you think voting should be more accessible? 800-642-1234. Republican State Senator Kathy Bernier of Chippewa Falls is Majority Caucus Vice Chair and Chair of the Committee on Elections. Her district includes Eau Claire, parts of Chippewa, Dunn, and Clark counties. Senator Bernier, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's dive into these 10 proposed bills. A few restrict who can qualify as indefinitely confined. Why are these adjustments necessary?
Well, indefinitely confined was specifically for those who are elderly, infirmed, disabled. And individuals who are not able to go out, they're able to get out and vote, should not be using that provision. So apparently a lot of people did. I know that I've been told that only 20% of the people didn't have a photo ID on file, but that 20% was 40,000 people. That's a lot.
And so you think that it was abused in the presidential election?
Yes.
So indefinitely confined voters and absentee voters would need to provide an ID for each election. You know, and currently clerks are able to keep one on file. Why isn't the current policy sufficient?
Well, you have to bear in mind that I didn't author all of these bills, so I want to make that very clear right now. The bills that were proposed are authored by Senator Strobel and Alberta Darling primarily. There's a few others. I do have some that I'm working on, but these bills are a work in progress. I've had conversations with the authors. There's some concerns that I have with a few of them. And so I want to make sure that we have the ability for people to say, here's who I am, and I am the individual voting, and to assure that there's integrity in the process. But I'm not necessarily in agreement with all the provisions of many of the bills.
Yeah, so if they're a work in progress, what are you clearly supporting in this package, and what do you want to be tweaked, lost, or otherwise, or you know, relooked at?
Well, I'm supporting the ballot box. You know, we didn't even have ballot boxes in the past, and I think it's probably a good thing. I think an individual who wants to make sure that their ballot gets there and not real confident they want to sell it or send it through the mail, have an opportunity to take it in there. And if the clerk is closed, you know, my clerk closes at noon on Friday. And if there's been numerous times that I've wanted to go in after 12 noon on Friday. And so I should be able to stop by and put my ballot in the drop box. So I encourage that proposal.
And just for some backstory here, you were Chippewa County Clerk for years.
Yes, over 12 years. So I trained 150 poll workers. I worked and trained with, there had to be 35 approximately municipal clerks. So, yeah, things have changed quite a bit in the last 12 years, but... I've been a part of that process and a part of those change in writing election laws. So I know the process pretty well.
Let's bring in George now in Ashland. George, hi. What is your question?
Well, good morning. It's not a question. I just wanted to say that mail-in voting makes me a much, much better informed voter. In years gone by, election day rolls along, you haven't researched your candidates, you don't even know who they are. Now you got to go to the polls and vote, but you don't really always know who you're voting for. Now I get a ballot 3 weeks in advance. I look at it, I open it up, I say, oh, okay, I got to find out who these people are. I do the research, I mark my ballot, I mail it in. I'm far, far better voter.
George finding himself to be a more engaged voter in the process. Senator Bernier, how do you see absentee voting?
Oh, I'm absentee voting is not going away. And if one prefers that, they certainly have that right. I don't think Wisconsin will get rid of Election Day voting. I think that we're also an engaged electorate, and we want to go to the polls on election day and do our patriotic duty and get our I voted sticker. So I have no problem with individual asking to receive an absentee ballot. I currently receive my absentee ballots, if at all possible, because oftentimes, especially in a primary, I happen to have a session day. I don't think my colleagues who set the days recognize that primaries we should vote too. So it happens for me.
You've said absentee voting is easier to abuse. What instances, what examples are there of that being an issue in Wisconsin?
Well, we have had about 45 on a general election that are actually found and investigated. There's a lot of, you just have to deter. That is the whole point of election laws. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any, right? The idea is to deter individuals from voting more than once and voting illegally. So, We can do both. We can have election laws, and we can still be open, transparent, and accessible. And I think that's mainly our point, is we want to deter people from cheating. I was talking with Megan Wolf not long ago.
Who heads the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, Megan Wolf from the Wisconsin Election Commission. And I spoke with her about how many voter fraud cases she expects that we will find. And now bear in mind, the ones that are glaringly obvious are the ones that we prosecute. No one goes through all of the list and all of the addresses to determine whether this is an actual individual. But the glaringly obvious ones come out in the electronic systems. She expects that we'll have more than 100 from this previous election, the November election.
We're looking at proposed changes to Wisconsin's elections. We have State Senator Kathy Bernier of Chippewa Falls. What changes do you think should be made to Wisconsin's election laws? Do you support restricting who is eligible to vote absentee? Do you think voting should be more accessible? Join in at 800-642-1234. You know, Senator Bernier, I keep having flashbacks to a year ago, nearly a year ago, that spring election when hundreds of thousands of voters cast absentee ballots ahead of time. Thousands of people turned out to vote in person. The snaking lines in Milwaukee, voters waiting for hours on end, trying to be vigilant about social distancing. Green Bay voters waiting past midnight to cast a ballot. How is your Committee on Elections and election process reform ensuring that those barriers never happen again?
Well, those are two very poor examples because the rest of the state did very well in April. The only reason why there were long lines and problems on Election Day is because we had mayors who decided to make the decisions for the municipal clerks on closing down polls. Dane County in Madison did great. They did perfectly fine because they didn't shut down all their polling places. So that is the municipal clerk or the election commission's responsibility, not a mayor or anyone else, to make decisions on how many polling places should be open. That was just foolish, and it's not even worth commenting on.
You are chair of the Senate Elections Committee. When do you expect to hold public hearings on these bills?
Very, very soon. I'm going to break them out to probably three different hearings. As I told my colleagues that we're going to delve into each one in the details, and we're going to have full hearings on it with people able to discuss. You know, to bear in mind, I'm working with the disability community on the indefinitely confined because I really truly believe that we have to have a better provision for individuals who are, you know, my church, we used to call them shut-ins, people who, they're many of them older or don't have, even those with disabilities don't have assistance with voting or anything else, very few times that they can get some assistance. So that one needs to be worked on significantly.
Yeah, and Disability Rights Wisconsin has spoken out against these bills, saying it would make voting harder for voters with disabilities. What changes are you hoping to work out to these bills so they don't deter voters with disabilities?
Oh, well, any bill can be amended. Matter of fact, I've got a phone call coming up or a Zoom meeting coming up with a disability rights individual. I can't remember the name of the organization. And we, you know, they have some ideas, you know, we'll kind of delve into some of the detail. But we do know that the indefinitely confined was used by individuals improperly and illegally. Fortunately, one guy from Florida didn't get away with it. And he was turned in by a friend from Sawyer County. So
I want to look a little more closely here. What about caregivers or elderly couples who, you know, someone they're caring for is indefinitely confined and yet they are not? And so, you know, why isn't it acceptable for the caregiver or that elderly couple to be both have that designation?
Well, if you're able and capable to get out, so I've already had this conversation with the disability community. So if we define it as you're unable to leave your home without assistance as desired, then that would define you as indefinitely confined. And so if you're able to go to the grocery store whenever you want, you're able to go, you know, hop in the car and get gas, you're not indefinitely confined. you have to have a specific designation for that. Whether, you know, if you're a caregiver, that means you can be out and about. That doesn't designate you as indefinitely confined.
We have State Senator Kathleen Bernier of Chippewa Falls, chairs the five-member Senate Committee on Elections, Election Process Reform, and Ethics. It includes two Democrats, three Republicans. How do you feel about how elections were run in 2020? Did you wait in long lines amid the pandemic? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute, more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with State Senator Kathy Bernier of Chippewa Falls. She chairs the Senate Committee on Elections. We're looking at a package of bills that GOP lawmakers say are aimed at restoring trust in the electoral system. And State Senator Bernier is with us for 10 more minutes. Mac is joining us from Elroy with thoughts on this. Mac, hi, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I'd just like to know that if there's a projected 100 cases of voter fraud within Wisconsin, then what's the reason, where's the trust been lost, and why are we seeing new legislation and policy being written that's affecting all of Wisconsin? Because it seems that 106 million is a relatively inconsequential figure. Thank you so much.
Mac, thank you. Senator?
Well, those are the only ones that come out during a electronic search process. There's others that won't ever show up because no one verifies the addresses or the individuals that are who they say they are. So out of those 40,000 people who are have no ID on file for indefinitely confined, you would have to, if it'll show that there's a match on a date of birth and a name and that information, but it doesn't show that that individual is actually the person who registered. So, like I said, you would have to go down around, like somebody would have to turn you in, like what was done in Sawyer County. The individual who had knew this person from Florida was trying to put his address as or his residence, and the individual from Sawyer County turned him in. That may have been the only way that that guy would ever been caught, potentially. So that is why you have to have such high integrity in the electoral system, because a lot of people
will these bills do that? Will these bills give you that integrity, restore confidence in elections? Will that be the result?
Certainly. The more difficult you make it to cheat, the higher the integrity of the election. I think a lot of these bills have to be fine-tuned. I agree with the premise of them. But there's, I don't want the indefinitely confined individuals to be overburdened. I mean, my grandson has two sisters who have half sisters that have cerebral palsy. They're in wheelchairs. I've known them all my life, or I've known them almost all of their life, and they're sweet and adorable. And I don't want them to be overburdened. And I have concerns about if you are indefinitely confined and you have MS or multiple some sort of physical disability, you have to provide a photo ID and medical information if you're under age 65. And over 65, you don't have to have medical information. I have a concern about that, yes.
What is your concern about that?
Well, it seems I'm going to be 65 soon. Whether I'm 64 and a half or 60 or 65, I can still provide my ID and I'm still, you know, very capable. And yet, if I had a significant disease or that I'm dealing with, and I would have to provide medical information, I don't know. I'm just not happy with that one.
The ACLU is also very concerned about this package, saying that it adds barriers to voting. What do you make of that? Where do you see the barriers in this package?
Well, I'm not sure. I guess I'd have to know which barrier they're talking about rather than general barriers. I think for the most part, we want just everyone to vote and everyone to vote legally. And for the integrity, part of our issue is that individuals don't trust the process or the system. So in order to, we have a wonderful organization, agency called the Legislative Audit Bureau. And so I'm, as we go along and have hearings on the bills and determine which ones will go forward and what needs to be amended and all of that, we're also waiting on the Audit Bureau. And the Audit Bureau is going to be auditing the indefinitely confined. Now we have some, we have an agency because I know DAs and law enforcement are busy doing really difficult law enforcement. But we have the Audit Bureau who's going to look at, under a microscope at all of the processes and procedures in the Wisconsin Election Commission and the electoral process. And they're going to come back to us to say, you know, they didn't find anything here. Here's what they found there. And that is invaluable. And we will utilize them to determine, okay, they can help us investigate the indefinitely confined and that, you know, 40,000 plus. And do they really exist or not or whatever. So we're, you know, I want to slow roll until we get the audits done, and they'll get us information as they go along, so we don't have to wait to the very end.
For their analysis, let's go to Anne now in Campbellsport with a question. Anne, go ahead.
Hi. It seems to me everything I've heard that voter fraud is virtually non-existent, and so I'm wondering what is the penalty for committing fraud. And I think it's somewhere, you can correct me here, I think it's somewhere like $10,000 to $100,000 and up to 2 years in prison. So instead of making voting harder for people, wouldn't it be more advantageous to spread the word on the penalties for this crime? And I think that would solve all your problems, and I don't think you need to restore any trust. I think we all do trust our election system.
State Senator.
Well, yes, it's a Class I felony for most election fraud cases. I've had a conversation with a current judge in Schuylkill County talking about this particular issue. I think a Class I felony is, in some cases, extraordinary. When it is deliberate fraud and provable, I have no problem with a Class I felony. What I do have, you know, so there are other election laws other than just fraud. There are other problems we've had in the electoral process where individuals don't follow the law, where observers are not allowed to be in and observe the process, which brings concern to the system, of course, and of course, then the individuals working the election are suspects.
We have to stop it there. State Senator, thank you for joining us.
Oh, sorry. Thank you.
Kathy Bernier is a Republican state senator from Chippewa Falls. She chairs the Committee on Elections. This is the Ideas Network.